now.
Pray to Mary.
It's a sin.
Don't doubt her.
Not to witness this in theaters.
This is the work of the devil.
Do you hear the voice?
Shh. The Unholy. Rated PG-13. Now playing in theaters.
Proud members of the Dread Podcast Network.
I am the writing on the wall, the whisper in the classroom.
I'm Marjorie Greene, and I approve this message. To save America, stop socialism, and stop China.
Stay the fire, we honor thee from life to death.
Pull out in real life.
Doubters, the doomsters, the gloomsters, they are going to get it wrong.
In the movies.
Where are you going to go? Where are you going to run? Where are you going to hide? Nowhere. Because there's no one like you left.
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
Let's go!
What are you waiting for, huh? What are you waiting for?
I want you to know that the movement we started is only just beginning.
Sometimes dead is better.
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high. Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow.
We're so glad to welcome you to another edition of Horror Hookups on Friday the 13th. If you're joining us for the first time, Horror Hookups are special episodes offering interviews with people from the industry, authors, directors, paranormal investigators, Sasquatch hunters. We've truly had them all. And today we welcome author Adam Sass, author of the new novel from Flux Books, Surrender Your Sons. In Surrender Your Sons, we meet Connor Major. Connor's SAT scores bombed. The old man he delivered meals to is dead. And when he came out to his religious zealot mother, she had him kidnapped and shipped off to a secluded island. His destination? Nightlight Ministries, a conversion therapy camp that will be his new home until he changes. But Connor's troubles are only just beginning. At Nightlight, everyone has something to hide, from the campers to the converted staff and cagey camp director. And it quickly becomes clear that no one is safe. Connor plans to escape and bring the other kidnapped teens with him, but first, he's exposing the camp's horrible truths for what they are and taking this place down. Surrender Your Sons is available now wherever you buy books, and we're so happy to welcome the author Adam Sass to the show. Adam, welcome.
Hi there. So good to be here. I love the intro there. It really captivated me.
Isn't that fun?
It's like a very like a radio play.
Yeah. We're only consummate professionals.
Exactly.
Right. You go in, yeah.
Well, Adam, welcome to the show, and thanks again for being with us. Since Surrender Your Sons is your first novel, a lot of listeners might not know who you are yet. Tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came to write the book, and most importantly, what was your relationship to horror? Did you grow up with horror movies? Is it something that you're now getting into later in life that you infused into your book? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So, Adam Sass here, former barista twink, now aged out into, I've had to find something else to do with my days. I came from a filmmaking background. So I was living in Los Angeles for about 20 years. And I just recently moved near to my family in North Carolina. So if you hear a little twang in my voice, there's that. It was one of those things where I was kind of doing a screenwriting thing, doing a like improv comedy thing, like just one of those general like LA gay like creative type paths where like it really wasn't like I wasn't focused in any way. It didn't really materialize into anything, unfortunately, but I had a lot of fun. I had my return of Saturn, so I turned 28 and I was like, oh, I need to do something different. And that's when, I kind of dug out this story that I kind of always wanted to tell, and it really was half formed, and it did end up becoming Surrender Your Sons. But what it was, I really wanted to do kind of, a revenge extravaganza piece, but with queer people at the center of it. So that's really crudely how Surrender Your Sons began. I didn't really know, like, I wasn't setting out to be like, I'm going to tell the stories of the horrors of conversion therapy and the survivors. You know, mm-hmm. that eventually is what it deepened into, because this took about 7 years for me to get right. Mm-hmm. And get from, like, my brain to your shelves. So it was a, kind of a little bit of a long winding road, which is kind of how I like to do things. But I did get there. And yeah, and so, you know, it still is a kind of, you could still read it in a way and have it be kind of this big, you know, revenge piece, like a Kill Bill type of thing. But really, the, you know, as I read more and met more conversion survivors and been researching it, like, the story definitely did deepen into something that's a lot more suspense, thriller, horror, tragedy piece there. So that's really me. And how I came about horror is, you know, yeah, I'm a movie guy. So, like, I'm, and horror is, I don't know. I mean, I think listeners and y'all kind of don't, are no stranger to this, but I think queer folks are really drawn to horror. I don't know what it is, but for me, it's a lot of the, I think you get a lot more, like, kind of feminine-centric stories, mm-hmm. a lot more kind of that energy. It's kind of like, you know, I like being scared of, like, kind of the big, wild emotions of it. I love the big choices that horror makes. I feel like I one of the things I skeeve the most are timid choices. So I think horror does that really, really, really strongly, where, like, for good or ill, yeah, these movies are wild. I was just, you caught me this morning, I was watching a whole bunch of, like, kind of breakdowns on, like, these 15-minute YouTube deep dives on, like, the story behind Poltergeist 3, and, like, a movie that means probably nothing to most people, but, like, I was just watching this, like, kind of deep dive breakdown on it, and, you know, and kind of the, you know, the intersections of, you know, how, like, even in a mess of a movie, there's value to be found. So I kind of really, really like that, that aspect. So that's really my, that's sort of my horror thing. But my I guess my intro to horror probably was, weirdly, like, you know, just, like, stuff that was on TV, I guess. Sure. Like, I think now, like, Netflix and Prime Video, I think, or Hulu even, are trying to do this, like, shuffle feature, where if you're not sure what to see, like, you can just shuffle, which I'm for, because I would always, like, you know, growing up, I would just be like, oh, I'll just put on whatever's on, and so I remember just being, like, a kid and watching, that's how I watched The Omen for the first time.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how I watched, like, the 1972 British Tales from the Crypt movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I now watch religiously, which they, I was so delighted that in, oh God, what, there was, I think it was an American Horror Story Apocalypse where they had Joan Collins, and they literally just had her redo her All Through the House
right.
Piece again. And I was, like, explaining the whole thing to my husband, who really couldn't have cared less. I was like, doing the exact same thing where she comes in with the poker and the, yeah. So it was like movies like that, and, like, Comedy Central would show, like, American Werewolf in London for some reason. They were out of comedies. I don't know what
exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's a funny movie. It belongs in there, but, you know, it like these kind of, like, these big wild choices, you know, for movies, and they're really kind of, like, the first kind of grown-up thing, I think, as a kid I got to see. So, like, it was sort of, like, the intro to darker themes, scarier stuff. And I think as a queer person as well, I was really drawn to horror movies because, like, in them, sometimes, like, the world is unfair and things don't work out and, oh, you're the main character and something really terrible happened to you and that's the end, like, all right, there you go. Like, it kind of, like, confirmed my very, like, negative dark world view early on. So actually,
speaking of being a young person, you know, in your bio on the jacket for Surrender Your Sons, it's mentioned that you grew up in an Illinois farm town. And so, of course, after reading the book, we can't help but notice, so did Connor Major, the main character in the book. So are some of Connor's experiences based on your own?
No. I'm not a conversion therapy survivor, but I made very clear in the acknowledgments of my book that my mom is in no way to be conflated with.
Thank God,
mom. I really needed to be because she was having. I mean, even though it's in the book, and even though, you know, all the thing, like, she was having, like, panic attacks leading up to the release of the book. She thought, like, everybody was going to be like some memoir. And I was like, it's going to be a long life if you're going to do this every time I have, like, a bad parent in a book. But no, I was in this kind of smaller town. I was in high school when Matthew Shepard was murdered, and a lot of the uninformed, kind of often bigoted, stupid things that would come out of their mouths around that time were traumatizing. So there is a sort of a hate crime within Surrender Your Sons that does take place kind of around the same time as Matthew Shepard did. Mm-hmm. A fictionalized one in my book, but that really was kind of the genesis of this. How does a modern queer kid like showing how a hate crime can really reach through generations? And this crime happened before my main character was even born, but it's still messing with his life in very, very serious ways. So I think that was the big thing that I pulled from my past. Sure. In that town, some good folks, some bad folks. My family itself was good, but I had to work through for a very long time a lot of resentment about them moving me there, because we came from a big city and they moved in. And that's kind of another thing with Connor, is that he was in a larger city, and then to sort of like the thing a lot of parents think is good for their kids, which is like, well, we need to move them out of the city and we need to get them into. And it's like, well, a lot of times for a queer kid, that's just murder, because you're moving them to probably a much less diverse area. You're moving them away from a lot of culture. I remember that was something that, like, we were close enough to Chicago that whenever we went to Chicago, it was a dream for me, because I just got to experience the life that I knew I needed to live. So a lot of that went into Connor. A lot of that sort of just very classic main character stuff, like almost Disney princesses. Like, just like, I need to get away from wherever this is. And then he is whisked away, but to kind of a nightmare world.
Yeah. Well, in a 2020 review in Teen Vogue, you mentioned that you're a huge Buffy fan. Now, that is a huge part of my life and my horror upbringings. Did any of kind of that style influence your writing at all?
For sure. I love, a lot of the great Buffy writers. I'm obsessed with, especially Jane Espenson. A lot of the Jane Espenson episodes of Buffy were filled with like dark humor. Like, even though there was these life and death things happening, it was always tied to like these jokes. They would joke their way through it.
Sure.
And I found that very relatable, because up through including today, like I process things that are troubling me through humor. And I think a lot of queer people do that. And so I feel like that as a queer person, and then as like a horror lover, I found that to be a very fascinating way to write, like to sort of a way to express the horror of the situation in a very personal, endearing, digestible way, but in a way that, like, even though there's humor, it's not making light of the trauma that it's causing. It's filtering it. It's kind of channeling it. It's not like sort of undercutting it.
Sure.
So I always really like Jane's episodes. So I definitely a lot of the Buffy writing kind of fits that mold.
So, Adam, as you know about our podcast, we're a podcast that looks at horror in real life and in the movies, and our listeners really are keenly aware of the horrors in our real world, especially, of course, our LGBTQ listeners, many of whom have had experiences just like Connor and his friends at Nightlight. Why was it important for you to tell a story of children overcoming conversion therapy in today's world?
I started writing this book kind of around when Marriage Equality passed in 2015. And there was it was sort of coming out of the It Gets Better era. And there was this sort of feeling of like, things have never been better. Why do queer kids keep killing themselves? Like, it was this sort of thing that a lot of like non-queer people were asking. I think a lot of them lacked the bandwidth or resources or knowledge, to compute that, to kind of look at like, well, there's all this progress. Why, it was kind of feeling like an epidemic at a certain point. A lot of these LGBTQ suicides, and that's something that, well, you know, that has been a constant throughout. That's not a it was not a new thing, but it was being reported on almost as if it was this sort of new thing that, like, why is this happening? And I found that very telling. So I kind of really conceived of, like, this kid, Connor, who was, you know, really left behind by a lot of the... Because I think a lot of folks think that, like, oh, well, we're done. We got marriage, we got whatever, fill in the blank, whatever you say. We got one sitcom on the air, so we're done. Like, mm-hmm. There's, you know, I think we're constantly fighting against that sort of, you know, this sort of thought process of... We get a certain amount of progress, and that means, okay, we can wash our hands of this, and you all should just be satisfied now. There's wounds that don't heal. There's things that have not been made right. There's things that are still not right. There's we all know that there is a backlash to progress, you know, like across all minority. Like, so I think that's something that, like, with Connor, I was like, I wanted to show the kid left behind by this. Mm-hmm. I wanted to show a kid who was able to open up YouTube and see all these, like, oh, I love my gay son, I'm gonna hug him, or, you know, I love my, you know, trans daughter, I'm taking the journey with her, and, you know, and sort of things, and, you know, see these things where there are progresses. But not for him. And that's an extremely lonely place to be in.
Yeah.
And that's sort of a continual joke I have with Connor, where it's like, oh, that's kind of, yeah, like, that's one thing gay guys love, is to see other people having a good time. They love that. We love seeing other people have a good time while we're in the shit. So I think that's something where I really wanted to take Connor was... What does that do to a person, a young person, especially who's very vulnerable, who's in a vulnerable, potentially facing homelessness place, where, you know, we got Glee, we have Simon, we have this, that, and to really show, like, no, here's what you're doing when you're saying it's all good and done. It's really saying that, like, you know, and it's not only just a lonely place to be. I feel like, you know, sometimes it makes them feel like, okay, that's just a problem with you then. And then it makes the pain kind of even more intensified. And he's dating a boy who is very out and is, you know, kind of blessed enough to have him, you know, be able to be out at home at school, be lauded and all that, and have a big Instagram thing. And he's dating this closeted kid. And so his boyfriend is like, okay, you know, like, kind of taking kind of cues from today and being like, well, you know, you just have to come out, and then, like, then your life begins, and then you're super happy. So, like, your life doesn't start until you come out without taking into consideration and appreciating all of the different complexities and challenges that would have for Connor. And Connor, because he is a pleaser and he wants to, and he's buying into this, and he wants to make his boyfriend happy, and he wants to have a big kissing on Instagram kind of relationship thing. He wants all that attention, and he wants to feel that love and to have things be okay. And so he does kind of buy into that, where he goes, okay, I'm not really me. I'm not living my life until I come out. I'm not really myself. And so he does it, and he comes out, and then disaster strikes. So that kind of leaves him in a place of, like, you know, so he's entering conversion therapy knowing that he's gay, not really wanting to be straight, but he's in a vulnerable place with that because his boyfriend and a lot of the community kind of fed him this line of, like, come out and you'll be okay.
Yeah.
And it gets worse for him. So it's kind of, he is in this sort of betrayed place when he enters Nightlight.
Well, you know, I'm really glad that you spent time with this particular, you know, part of the story, which is, you know, a very integral part of it, because, you know, just to contextualize it a little bit further for listeners, conversion therapy is only illegal in, I think, 85 municipalities and 20 states. So in other words, mm-hmm. in the majority of the country, maybe not in the majority of the population, but in the majority of the country, you know, conversion therapy is still a thing. It can still happen. Yeah. And the Williams Institute at UCLA estimates that before kids turn 18 this year, another 10,000 kids will go through conversion therapy. So just something to think about as you approach the book, especially listeners, when you buy this book, really think about that, that there's a very real and present danger when it comes to conversion therapy.
There is. And it's also, there's secular bans. This is stopping like therapists from doing this.
Yeah.
But if there, you cannot legislate religious organizations.
Right.
So that's a great deal of the conversion therapy. So even then, even with these bans, those only work to a point, and they only cover minors under 18. The idea being that, like, when you're 18, you're able to make your own decisions, not realizing that many people, especially young people who are over 18, live with many family puppet strings, either financial, you know, you live under my roof, so you have to do this. These sorts of things, these leverages that your family can have over you. And I think that was another big part of wanting to write this story, was because I was seeing in the wake of It Gets Better, there was all these anti-bullying campaigns, all of this focus on the classmates, the bullying from the classmates, which is real and happens and important. But all of them failed to even acknowledge the fact that a queer person's biggest bully can be in the home.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Speaking of the home, in the book, Connor experiences a really contentious relationship with his mother, who should have been protecting him, but ends up handing him over to kind of these abusers and these conversion therapists. Connor, you know, throughout the book, he wrestles with this relationship that he still wants to continue with her, even though she betrayed him. That had to have been really hard to write. And tell us about that choice for the book.
It was hardest to write because you don't want to do this to this sweet kid who does not deserve this in any facet of the imagination. But it was also hard because I was really committed to writing Connor's hopefulness for a future, a better future with his mother. That even though he is in this hellish camp, knowing his mother sent him there, knowing that when he leaves, he will be facing the same sort of puppet strings at home, believing that if he just says the right words, if he just does the right things, if he just makes a convincing enough case for his humanity, he'll get the mother that he knows back. A lot of the hardest parts to write were flashbacks and the sort of passages where Connor is having fond he keeps having these fond memories throughout this nightmarish place of his mom, like better times with his mom, when, you know, holidays and times she stuck up for him and all of these good times, and realizing that the more out he was, the older he became, the less best friends they became, and that loss, that pulling apart, that the more he struggles to get back to that good place with her, the further away she gets, was very, very hard, because writing hope is more painful, I think. I think if he was like, well, she can go buzz out. Like, I think if he was more like that, it would have been a far easier book to write, but it was much, much harder for him to remember these great times and really kind of dare to include love in there, because I think for a lot of people who have contentious relationships with families, they don't even need to be this contentious as Connor's is with his mom. That is the hardest part, is to reconcile these great, genuinely good, genuinely right memories with the abusive ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, Adam, you deal frankly with sexuality and desire and Surrender Your Sons. And I think some other authors in this realm, especially thinking about in a young adult book, they might have shied away from it. And I think you made the right choice here. I'm just wondering, because that really did help to create far more three-dimensional characters that seem very authentic. Was it a challenge to balance that writing in the story?
Yeah, it's always hard to write frankly about sexuality and desire. Mm-hmm. Not even in a young adult book, but especially in a young adult book, I think, as well, because I don't know. I mean, I've spoken a bit about this online. but there's a nuance to it because I think a lot of queer people, a lot of gay men specifically, we have a lot of baggage and shame around sex. I think all of us do, but I think specifically there is this sort of, you know, I think the big narrative for gays for decades was corrupting children.
Yeah.
So as a gay man who is writing for underage teens, basically, that was a huge terror. But I wanted to correctly reflect if this had happened to me, how I would be feeling. You have these feelings, you have these instances that you know, gay readers, queer readers deserve to see. The same type of, you know, intimacy scenes that you would see as a 14-year-old watching Titanic. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think for straight folks, that's just so confirmed in the world around you that really doesn't that never really comes up as much. And I think for us, especially other gay YA writers, that's hard. It's difficult. But I feel like specifically for this story, it was important because the thing they're being punished for is this. So it was very central to have that be part of that, to have this be part of this is something that is not just to really show. I wanted to show that Connor was that he was a fully he was, I guess a sexual person, you kind of call it, but he's not like repressed. He's not sure. Out, but he is not like denying any of these feelings. I wanted to show people that he was resisting even off the page, that he was saying like, no, I'm not saying like, oh, I don't think that. Like he's very, very frank. Like even people that he has no intention of like getting with, he'll kind of see another person in camp and just be like, oh, okay, I'm looking at it. You know, like for like a second in the middle of like, you know, these terrifying things happening, he will clock that someone is attractive. And then, you know, leading into probably more intimate territories where, you know, he begins potentially this romance with another camper who is much more repressed and is much more in denial of that. But having that, crossing that threshold was important for the other characters as well. So it's very key to the experience, but it is always, you know, a challenge. Not that anyone ever, you know, no one, even shopping this book around, these scenes were always a part of it. I was never, ever told, like, you can't put that in, or that's too far, or that's what, you know, whatever. You know, the biggest editor on that was myself, and so I think if you are going to be venturing into that, you kind of do need to just make sure you're telling it for the right reasons, including it for the right reasons, but also kind of trusting that, like, you have every right to include this in the story if you want.
Yeah. So shifting gears just a little bit to another relationship in the book, one of the ongoing plot points in Surrender Your Sons is the story of Ricky Hannigan. It's the old man that Connor delivered Meals on Wheels to, and upon his death, he receives a mysterious gift before he's kidnapped. When we meet Ricky, there's clues to his sexuality, but he's hiding it for whatever reason. The story becomes hugely important to him about him on the island, and kids discover more and more about the true depth of the darkness at Nightlight. Was there a person in your life that influenced the creation of Ricky, or is that something that you just came up with?
Mostly an invention, but you know, it was very important to me that that Surrender Your Sons be about intergenerational gay trauma, but also intergenerational gay support. That this was something that where it was very, very important to me that it not just be gay teens, and that, you know, gay adults don't serve any role in guidance and whatnot. But I wanted the biggest ally that Connor had before he was taken was this old man that he wasn't even really sure that, you know, that Ricky was gay or that there was anything there, but you know, Ricky has a connection to Nightlight, and Ricky has, you know, leaves Connor vital clues that help him in his investigation and resistance against Nightlight when he gets there. So this is something. So Ricky Hannigan was someone who, and I think, like I said before, it's really closely tied to my feelings about the Matthew Shepard murder. And so I think a lot of Ricky Hannigan for me was, what if Matthew had survived the attack, and his attackers were never found? If this was just a case of, you know, how quickly would it have lingered in the public consciousness? And what would his attackers not being found have done to the queer community's psyche? You know, would those wounds have been allowed to close? Not that they have closed at all in any way, but how horrible that unfinished business. And so that's something where Ricky faced a similar attack in the late 90s. And his attackers were not found, and those attackers are very, very closely linked to the central mystery of Nightlight that Connor begins to investigate while he's there. So this was something where, yeah, it probably was something that was a little more of an invention. I had, frankly, there's a lot more folks in my life who are more reminiscent of some of the people who work at Nightlight. Mm-hmm. Not that I received negativity from them, but there was a lot of people in my town who were closeted, and I had a feeling about them. And it kind of filled me with this kind of dread of, like, oh, I don't want to be that person, because they seem really upset and lonely and angry all the time, and just they don't seem happy. So I think that was like my first introduction to gay people, unfortunately, was sort of, you know, sort of people who seemed unhappy and laughed at and lashed out at people in town, and, you know, kind of took it out on other people. So that was something that, you know, a lot of this was very good therapy writing this, because a lot of it was like, oh, wow, that was like kind of my first introduction to it. Yeah, I think for a lot of folks it is, because I think that's what I don't think people realize the damages of the closet is that the closet changes people's personalities. It toxifies. It's very corrosive. And the longer you're in, the more toxicity you have to deal with, the more it kind of becomes part of your personality. So really, Surrender Your Sons is a horror story about the closet and in all the many different ways it can toxify a person. And and just how kind of splintered of a web it is. It doesn't just affect one person. You see how many people's lives it really does impact negatively.
Yeah.
You know, Adam, I'm glad that you talked about Matthew Shepard, because, you know, I was also in high school, as was Andrew. We're all in the same generation here when he was murdered. And I remember feeling so scared and, you know, looking back, reflecting now, just, you know, really considering how that had such an effect on my development as a young gay person, a young queer person. And that's sort of in counterpoint to one of my favorite characters in the book. And one of my favorite characters is actually Lucretia. And Lucretia is this, she's kind of a small character, but she has a huge role. And she's just incredibly mighty and incredibly brave. And for listeners out there, she's one of the fellow campers. And one of my favorite lines that she has is this one: "You're all talk unless you're willing to do the thing. You might not like it. You might not think you can, but there's nobody between us and these monsters. They know we're coming, but what they don't know is what we're willing to do." And it really seems like Lucretia there is speaking with this voice just far beyond her years, ready to fight for a future that she really wants. And I'm sure for the book, you really had to dig into the experience of young LGBTQ folks today. So in your research and in your conversations that you had, what did you find out about today's young people, today's, you know, especially queer young people, that's inspiring, hopeful, courageous?
Well, today's young people, I think, I think every generation really has been doing the thing. But, I mean, obviously, I think this Generation Z has been incredibly vocal, and they're a wonderful group of young activists. And yeah, and I think especially now more than ever, a long awaited sort of acknowledgement of that the queer community needs to be much more intersectional in the way we, you know, who is sort of leading charges, whose voices need to be lifted up way more, who have we heard probably too much of. And I think that's something where there's 12 campers in the book, including Connor. And what I wanted with these campers was to be a cross-section of the LGBTQ community. And I really wanted to show, because, you know, Connor is kind of demographically like myself, a white, cis, gay boy. And but I wanted the other campers to reflect a lot of these other voices of different intersectionalities, and really show that that like Connor doesn't have all the answers. He is not necessarily leading the charge out of Nightlight. He is arriving at Nightlight with very key information about Ricky Hannigan, which is kind of a mystery that people who have been at that camp much longer have been interested in and trying to unravel, but he arrives with this kind of firsthand knowledge about this. And so a lot of what Connor does is provide a lot of sort of lights the match, really, like, kind of is he's a chatterbox. He really doesn't, you know, think before he speaks. He kind of just goes in there. And a lot of these other campers have been really slowly, steadily growing a resistance in the background, but he kind of comes in and is like, well, why are we not escaping? Why aren't we getting out of here? And he does this stuff that really catalyzes everybody. But it was very important to me to show that this little white cis boy does not have all the answers, and in fact, sometimes he is hampering the everyone's escape plan. So I wanted to show this this arc of Connor's throughout the book, where it starts the book where he feels he is the only persecuted person in his life, in his sphere. And I think a lot of people kind of feel that way when they first come out, and then when you get kind of welcomed into the larger community, you realize all the different ways in which you have had more protections than other folks. And there are other people out there who do know more than you. And so I think Connor, with characters like Lucretia and other campers like Darcy and Jack, are able to kind of... Connor is able to defer to their judgment, their knowledge. They know this island a lot better. They have been living with the dangers a lot more. They have potentially better strategies. So I think that was something that was very key for me, because I think today's young generation is more aware than ever that those conversations need to be had, and that other voices do need to be long in the making, lifted up.
Yeah. So in the book, Connor is not forced, but is encouraged by his boyfriend to come out of the closet maybe earlier than what he wanted to. And for him, it's a more dangerous situation. You know, we talked a little bit about it gets better. And, you know, in the long run, Connor may get that, but he really has to go through hell to get there. If there's a young person out there listening right now and thinking about coming out or is being encouraged to come out, what would you tell them?
I mean, I would just say, you know, I would encourage them to say, to look at themselves and just, and look in the mirror and just say, whenever I come out, I'm still me. Like, you're still you. You're not, like, I would not buy into any talk that makes you feel like you're not really living your life until you come out. I came out at 19. 20 even, I think, to my family. I came out to friends at 19. I had a full life before then, and I have many good memories, and it's not all poison. So I think that I think having this sort of narrative of, well, your life doesn't really start until that point. Parts of that are true, but I would really say that the most important thing you should do is really objectively look at your situation, and just think like, okay, is this the right, you know, what could potentially be held over me? Should this not go well? I would think it would, I talk of it like kind of you're kind of becoming a spy in your own home, which maybe doesn't feel great, but I think it does put a little of the control and power back into your hands. as a young closeted person to just be, okay, do you think there's a risk of you not getting your college paid for? Do you think there's a risk of you losing your car or your phone? Something that does happen to Connor and very quickly isolates him in a very major way. I would think, like, at that point, it's not, except I think it's about making sure that, making sure that, like, you could still have your college paid for. You can still have, you know, I think go through the hierarchy of needs. Like, will you still be housed? Will you still be fed? Will you still have your bills paid? Will you still have access to these things that connect you to the outside world? Like I was saying, when I lived in my small town, and it really gave me life to kind of go to the city of Chicago and experience shows and theater and museums and people and different people on the street and different restaurants. We had the one pizza joint in my town. That was it. So, like, don't discount those things as nothing. So, like, will you still have access to these things that allow your life to be rich? Then, sure. But also, like, in general, like, it's your own pace. I'm generally for, if the circumstances are correct and you're safe and you're fine and people will be cool with you, I'm generally for, yeah, your life will be probably more simpler if you have the language to say that. A lot of folks later in life don't develop that language. It develops at all different times. So I'd say if you have full knowledge of this and you feel like, you know, you would not be risking much at all to do that, then I would encourage you, yeah, like, come out then. Especially if it could help someone else. Mm-hmm. Because your visibility helps someone else who may not be in as good of a position as you are. Because I think that's the thing. I think it's a little of A and B. A being your own personal safety and well-being. And then B being, will your visibility help someone else?
Adam,
I think you have to consider
both. Yeah, for sure. I think that's a great answer. And you know, too, for if there are young folks out there listening, and if there are any people that are dealing with conversion therapy issues or survivors looking for resources, a couple of resources I would direct you to: bornperfect.org and the trevorproject.org, two great resources to check out. But Adam, for you, in the meantime, what's next for you? Are we going to hear any more about Connor's journey in the world? What do you think?
There are no plans as of yet. Right now, Surrender Your Sons is a very self-contained story. I would encourage everybody also, like, if you've read the book and kind of want to experience it a different way, I can't recommend enough the audiobook, which is narrated by Daniel Henning. I wrote the thing, and I, listening to the audiobook, I was like, oh, wow, he really kind of, like, is showing me a few different things, levels to the story that I didn't realize before.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's actually how I listened to it.
Oh, wonderful. That's great. Isn't it great? Yeah, he's fantastic. He does so much good work, and he recorded all of this in quarantine in his own recording studio, so it was great. But I really encourage that audiobook. As far as what's next for me, there's a few more books coming out that I can't really talk about, but I can talk about. I will be appearing in an anthology called Out There that's coming out in May 2022. It's gay-focused. My story is gay-focused. Young adult sci-fi fantasy. So sort of my own little Twilight Zone episode happening. So for horror fans who like Twilight Zone out there, check out my story in Out There in May.
Awesome. Well, Adam, thanks so much for being with us today. And listeners, you can get Adam's book, Surrender Your Sons, pretty much wherever books are available. So go out there and grab your copy ASAP. As always, if you want to learn more about Friday the 13th, become a Patreon patron or buy some merch, visit us on our brand new updated website at www.friday13.com.
Thanks for being with us for another horror hookup on Friday the 13th. Adam, thanks again for being with us. And as always, don't forget to
get slayed.